Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Pinchas. This week, Rabbi David Levenkruz discusses Pinchas. Rabbi David Levenkruz is a senior member of the Pardes faculty and also serves as the Pardes Director of Special Programs. And now, Rabbi David Levenkruz.
Thank you, Larry. The story of Pinchas is a classic example of what philosophers will call a hard text, a historical text that is problematic. I prefer to call it a yucky, icky, toxic, problematic text. But first, look at the text itself. At the end of last week's parsha, at the end of the parsha of Balak, we read that there is a problem with the Israelites joining themselves with Baal Peor. God is angry, and Moses says that everybody who has joined Baal Peor should be stopped. This is because of their idolatry. And then, in fact, what happens is that somebody from Israel cohabits with a Midianitish woman in the sight of Moses and all of Israel. And Pinchas sees this. He cannot bear what is going on. He goes into their room and takes a spear, thrusting through both of them. And the plague that had been existent stopped. And in this week's parasha, God says that Pinchas turned the wrath away, and therefore he is given a covenant of peace, and the priesthood shall be, his children will be priests, and then the names are given of the people who were involved. A text that many of us might find problematic. It seems excessive force in this situation. Why does God praise Pinchas? Is this a religion that if people disagree, they put to death? They weren't doing murder. It wasn't even necessarily adultery in the later sense of the word. What is going on over here? Why does Pinchas behave in such an extreme way? Very, very often, Jews are very quick to point out in other religions examples of zealotry or things that seem excessive. Here it seems as if we have the very, very same thing in our own faith system. And of course, many, many answers are presented to this. What I'd like to do today is not to look at this text only, but look at the whole issue of dealing with yucky, icky, toxic, problematic texts in Judaism in general. And I will use Pinchas as a theme very, very often, but really to deal with the whole issue of how do I deal with texts that are repugnant or disgusting, offensive to the sense or sensibilities, having the effect of poison and constituting or presenting a problem or difficulty. Not all texts are the same for everybody. Different people have different orientations. And it's very, very important sometimes, like a person may not find a text repugnant. That doesn't mean that there's anything the matter with them. Similarly, people might find repugnant a text that others don't. That's fine. But I think it's very important to realize that texts that are not problematic for us can be for others, and can be leveraged in painful and unexpected ways. And similarly, that texts that I find troubling may not bother others. I've done a lot of research on this. First of all, I want to thank Greg Drinkwater and Yechiel Hoffman for their help with preparing the shiur. I used a lot of old Shema magazines. I did a lot of research. Very few of the ideas are my own. What I've done more is taken from other places. And one of the cleverest ideas that I got was to use the work of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was a famous psychologist who spoke about the five different stages that people go through in death or whenever something else very difficult happens, which are denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. I have taken these based on the idea of somebody else, and basically used them more or less as a construct for us to look at the different ways the texts have been dealt with. First, denial, then anger and sadness, bargaining, and finally acceptance and challenge. Because in some way, a text that is difficult for us to deal with is like a little death. It's a tradition that one may love, or one may be very, very attracted to, which suddenly one finds is not giving one what one needs. And very, very often the feeling can be shame, anger, sadness, horror, rebellion, rejection, discomfort, or questioning. So today we're going to take Elizabeth Kubler's taxonomy, more or less, and use it to try and understand Pinchas in particular, but how Jews deal with difficult texts in general. So let's start off with denial. And denial has got a number of components. The first one is absolute, utter rejection. Somebody might say, you're just applying Western thoughts to non-Western texts. You have a trouble with Pinchas, but that's just because you're a pinko liberal. You don't understand. This was Am Yisrael. This was God speaking. This is righteous indignation. This is zealousness in the service of God. All you're doing is you're taking some Western liberal notion and you're applying it to the text. And there are many, many people who do say this. And I think it is a strong argument. But I think it's also important to realize that the Talmud, medieval scholars, also had these same issues. These issues did not start in 1960 or 1965. They did not start in 1760 or 1765. Throughout our history, the rabbis have been bothered by it. But certainly there is this idea that when we find text problematic, we may be taking our own notion of what is right and wrong and applying it elsewhere. Another form of rejection is to reject the Torah altogether. This is what Stephen Hawking and his like have done. They say, look, not only is the Torah not true, not only is it backward, not only does it keep science from advancing, but you have here, and Stephen Hawking says this a lot, you have here a bad text like Pinchas that encourages zealousness. This is why all the wars in history have happened. Stephen Hawking does say that. It may be an exaggeration. It may not be true, but he does say that. This is why everything is, I reject the Torah. So the first form of denial is to reject it, either because we are applying non-Western notions to Western, to non-Western texts, or we reject the Torah altogether. Another denial strategy is avoidance, and that is to ignore the problematic text and focus instead on passages that validate one's own personal or communal values. I read a very interesting critique of Rabbi Jonathan Sachs's books, which I personally like very, very much. And the critic said that he often bases himself on the Bible and comes up with these very beautiful readings about pluralism and of respecting the other. But one could do the same thing. One could use the Bible and use examples like Pinchas, use examples of the conquering of the nations, use many, many examples and come up with a very, very different kind of a text and a type of a message. So very, very often people will ignore problematic texts and focus on passages that they like. And in fact, this is not just a personal strategy, but in Megillah, in the Tractate of Megillah, in the Babylonian Talmud, towards the end, page Kaf Hei, Amud Aleph and Bet, 25a and b, which discusses scrolls and liturgical recitation of texts, there is a whole passage about passages which are read but not translated. In those days, there was a meturgaman, there was a translator who would translate the Torah as it was being read, and certain passages were read but not translated, as well as texts that were just not read at all. In other words, early on our tradition, we decided to emphasize certain values and downplay others. And this is one of the most vital ways in which traditions grow and adapt. Very, very often we feel it's a question of rejecting or innovating, but very, very often the way that a tradition grows is by highlighting certain texts and downplaying others. We also have the famous example of Ktiv V'Kri in when we are reading the written versus the read. Very, very often we will substitute a euphemism for a harsh word in a liturgical reading. And finally, there is a form of avoidance which avoids looking what the text is saying head on, but will instead focus on minutiae, grammar, word choice, will find a sweet idea within a more difficult passage. All of these, avoiding a head-on approach, substituting of a euphemism, choosing to emphasize certain things and not others, all of these are part of avoidance, which is a form of denial. The final form of denial is it just can't be. It can't be that this text that I love so much is speaking in this way. A oft-told story is Reb Chaim of Volozhin, who was a great leader in Lithuanian learning, would go in the middle of the night and see whether any abandoned babies had been placed on his step. He couldn't sleep at night knowing that there might be a baby outside crying. And I've heard it written, it can't be that Reb Chaim of Volozhin believed in the Torah and he saw all the problematics of Amalek and of the Sota and whatever issues you might have trouble with. It can't be that Reb Chaim of Volozhin, who was such a good man, could believe in a system that was flawed in some way. In many, many ways, the whole Talmud is doing this. So much of the Talmud is the rabbi's inner conviction that their form of understanding is right. It can't be that the text thinks differently, and therefore it goes on to try and prove that the text is saying something different. So we have three types of denial: rejection, avoidance, and saying it can't be. The next step, if we use our modified Kubler-Ross, is anger or sadness. Silence, just feeling the pain. When Moses tells Aaron that his sons have been killed at the dedication of the first tabernacle, Aaron's response is silent. It could be acknowledgement that this too is the way of God. It could be that Aaron is so angry that he doesn't know what to say. But one of the things I always say to people is if you have a problematic text, allow yourself to feel the problems. Don't rush to the sweet answer. Don't rush to the nice answer. Don't rush to make nice. One of the things that makes our tradition interesting is because it has problematic texts. Otherwise, it would all be just sweet. We need to let the impact of the text hang in the air in its tragedy and difficulty, untainted by piety or apology, allowing a text to wash over as it is in all its troubling aspects, making ourselves ask, even, and this is very, very important, even if this text is problematic, what do I have to learn from it? It's a very, very mature person who can do it. But sometimes there can be a text which I find difficult or problematic, like Pinchas. What can I learn from it? Even if I don't agree that you should go and stab people who are doing something against what God wants, I can learn about zealousness. I can learn about having the ability to act according to one's convictions. I can learn the ability of sometimes doing things immediately and not waiting around. I can learn having the courage of my convictions. There's so much that I'm able to learn from this text about Pinchas. I can learn that sometimes in life, life demands from us to do things that are morally problematic. It's hard to go through a war. It's hard to go through a difficult circumstance and be absolutely clear. And part of what I can learn from the Pinchas story, even if I disagree with his actions, is sometimes life demands certain difficult actions to be done. So a second sphere is anger, sadness, silence, feeling the pain, and also allowing the text to wash over oneself and asking oneself, what can I learn from this text? So we have denial, we have anger and sadness, and next we have bargaining. Call it divine dialectic, calling it having your cake and eating it too. But this bargaining is what much of Jewish learning, certainly in traditional frameworks, classically is. And this consists of five different spheres. So one is the sphere of classic Midrash and medieval commentaries. When there are problematic passages, they may be purified through creative interpretation. It doesn't mean this, it actually means that. When people behave unjustly, we give reasons for their behavior. As in our case, God said it, there was a plague. It wasn't as if he wasn't in an atmosphere where this seemed to be like a good thing. We can reduce the relevance of a particular situation. We do with this Pinchas as well. Commentators will say that was a story. It's not a halakha. It's not something for you to do. These were very, very specific circumstances that allowed Pinchas to behave that way. We can spiritualize something physical. We can say, oh, this is not a story that is meant to be taken historically. It's talking about the Pinchas within ourselves. This is something the Hasidic texts often do. They will speak about a story, and mystical texts, they'll speak about a story, not as the story itself, but representing certain parts within ourselves. We can change the context or try and understand it in context. We can reread a text completely. For example, classically in the Torah, a woman who has been raped has to marry the rapist. But the rabbis will say, no, that is only with her consent. So one method of bargaining is what the classic Midrash and medieval commentators do. They purify passages with their creativity. They give reasons for unjust behavior. They reduce the relevance of a particular situation, spiritualize something physical, change the context, or reread texts completely. Another methodology of bargaining is apologetics, which is the branch of theology concerned with the defense and rational justification of a viewpoint. This is a defensive method of argument, which often the aim will be not so much to find out the truth about Pinchas, but to somehow justify what he did. Another thing that people do is contextualize textually. Often when we look at things in context, they're usually not so bad. If we look at Pinchas, this was a specific situation, we will say. The problem with this is that sometimes it's worse when one sees the context. And also sometimes there are good things which we do not look so great once we look at them in context. So we have the classic Midrashim, apologetics, contextualizing textually. And then we have the guns don't kill people, people kill people. The idea, and this can go in two ways. One is that if we look at the pshat, it may not mean what tradition has made it mean. And the other will say, don't look at pshat, look at what tradition has done with it. This does happen sometimes, that the trouble isn't the text itself, but how it has been used or misused or exploited by people or used to justify or validate, sometimes retrospectively, troubling beliefs or actions. This has certainly happened with Pinchas, that people have been behaved badly and said that they're doing it because of Pinchas, or they use Pinchas as the example of somebody who behaved in a certain way. And very, very often when one goes back to a text, one can sometimes feel, for example, with Dina, the rape of Dina, it can be read, well, actually this makes the text harder, so I'm just going to leave that idea. And the last one, which people often use, is contextualize historically. People will say with Pinchas, in those days that was acceptable, the Torah was clearer, or people might say in those days women had a certain position in society. That's why they were treated that way. That certain things worked in terms of the times and make sense in terms of their times. This does not work now, and very often we will say that only applied then. Pinchas was only for a very, very, very specific time. This really is the heart. Probably many, many podcasts and many much learning is really around these different ideas. What the classic Midrash and medieval commentaries do, apologetics, contextualizing textually, guns don't kill people, people kill people, connecting historically. So we have these different strategies, which join with anger, sadness, silence, feeling the pain, and allowing the difficulty to wash over one. And these join denial, which consists of rejection, avoidance, or a feeling that it just cannot be. And then we come to the last, perhaps the most difficult one, which is acceptance of these texts and or, and it could be the same thing, challenging these texts. Sometimes an acceptance involves challenging at the same time. So the first one is we question the text using the text itself. Remember that Pinko, the person who called us Pinko liberals, who said, we just have problems with Pinchas because of our Western values. Well, it's not just our Western values. Where did the West get these values from? Where do we get these values from? They come from the Torah. The Torah is what teaches us about due process. The Torah is what teaches us what you're allowed, in which situations you're allowed to kill and which ones you aren't. We remember Abraham's interaction with God concerning the destruction of Sodom and Amorah. He argues with God and says, Hashofet kol ha'aretz, shall not the judge of all the earth do justly? Abraham says to God, are you living up to the ethical standards which you demand? We judge the text by the standard of this text itself. Is this text living up to the standards demanded by these texts? Is this text consonant with that found in rabbinic literature in general? Or is this text an aberration? In other words, other parts of the text are used to critique it. It says that sin goes down to the third or the fourth generation, but it also says that the son shall not be put to death for the sins of the fathers and vice versa. So one of the things is we question the text using the text itself. It's internal. It's a debate. Different parts of the Torah modify other parts of the Torah. Sometimes we write new commentaries. To express our revulsion, we may rewrite a text. What's especially fascinating is when people use new understandings of languages in their time to bolster new interpretations. Sometimes the interpretations are just written out of our own feelings, but very, very often there are modern commentators who use their understanding of language, and I will actually mention the Dina example. It makes what happened later worse, but it actually makes her situation more complex, and that is that there's a way to read Vayan when she is raped, according to most translations, as also she is pleasured. In other words, it gets rid of the rape scene. Now, this makes the subsequent action even more problematic, but it's just very, very interesting to see Dina in a new light. So people question the text using the text themselves. People write new commentaries. And sometimes people say, a story like Pinchas makes me question revelation altogether. It makes me wonder where the Torah actually comes from God. And of course, we live in a world in which we have the field of Bible criticism, which sees the Torah not as having been written by Moses and given in the desert, but as having a history and as having been created and developed over a period of time. Some deny the Torah the authority it is presumed to have and refuse to accept the infallibility of God as presented in sacred texts. Abraham rebelled against an unjust commandment at Sodom. At the Akedah, at the binding of Isaac, he realized he had done wrong. Some more moderate views of this idea say that revelation was real, but people wrote it down and colored it through their own lenses. Rabbi Louis Jacobs feels this way, that therefore, when we find something that we really believe in and we believe is true, that did come from God, but when we find something that we don't like, that was colored by human beings. This, of course, is a very, very hard game to play, because what one person sees as colored by God, as colored by people, another person will really see as coming from God. Tamar Ross, the feminist, the Orthodox feminist thinker, speaks of cumulative theology, that in each generation, the right Torah for that time is given, but as times change, there is a different Torah for that particular time. What this does, unlike Jacob's, is it does not get rid of, does not cause dispersions of the past. That was the right thing for its time. Pinchas, in his context, was doing the right thing, but it's not the way we should behave now. And finally, we have the most radical solution, which is questioning whether this is Torah. After the golden calf, Moses argues with God, and Moses says to God, "Forgive your people, or if not, blot me, I pray you, out of your book which you have written." Moses says, "I do not want to be part of this if you do not forgive the Jewish people." And some Jews might say that this text is so troubling for me, this is not Torah. In some way, we are full circle with some of these arguments. We're back to the beginning of rejecting completely. But I think it's a very different type of rejection. Whereas the first one was either walking away from Torah or walking away from the West. What we're saying over here is, I want to stay in the system, but I'm not sure whether for me this is Torah. I want to stay in the system, but I'm not sure if all of this comes from God. So we've seen a very large gamut of ways to deal with things. To reject, to avoid, to say it can't be, to be silent, to feel the pain, and to see what one can learn from a hard text. To engage in the same work that classical midrashim and medieval commentaries do. To engage in apologetics. To contextualize textually. To look at the pshat. To contextualize historically. To question the text using the text itself. To write new commentaries. To question revelation. Or to question if this is Torah. All of these are ways that our tradition and people today deal with hard text like Pinchas. The difficult text can limit the depth of our engagement with Torah. Whether we justify its faults or fail to behold its wholeness, often we in the Torah can feel fragmented. But I feel the opposite. I feel that what makes our tradition rich is that it has problematic texts, and we have to deal with it. Working through Pinchas and its problematics can be a very, very wonderful way of getting closer to the Torah and closer to the values we hold most dear. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Levenkurs. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you in the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.